The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On this episode of Newt's World, Abraham Lincoln grappled with the greatest crisis of democracy that has ever confronted the United States. While many books have been written about his temperament, judgment, and steady hand in guiding the country through the Civil War, we know less about Lincoln's penetrating ideas and beliefs about democracy, which were every bit as important as his character in sustaining him through the crisis. In his new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment, award-winning historian and best-selling author Alan Gelzo captures the president's firmly held belief that democracy was the greatest political achievement in human history. He shows how Lincoln's deep commitment to the balance between majority and minority rule enabled him to stand firm against secession, while also committing the Union to reconciliation rather than recrimination in the aftermath of war. Here to discuss his new book, I am really pleased to welcome my guest, Alan Gelzo. He is perhaps best known as one of the most respected Lincoln scholars in the world. He is a senior research scholar at the Council of Humanities at Princeton University, and the author of several books about the Civil War, including Gettysburg and Robert E. Lee. He has been the recipient of the Lincoln Prize 3 times and the Guggenheim Lehrman Prize for Military History. He's also someone I regard as a close friend and who I turn to for advice regularly. Alan, welcome, and thank you for joining me again on Newt's World.
Well, thank you very much, Newt. It's good to talk again, and especially to have an opportunity to talk about Abraham Lincoln.
Well, a point you make, which is the United States is the longest still-functioning large-scale democracy in the world. What makes it different from the ones that have failed?
Well, one thing which certainly has helped the United States that way are two oceans. That has kept us from, as a democracy, being constantly under assault. And there's a sense in which those two oceans protected us from the very beginning. We had, at the beginning of the American Republic, already an empire on our western border, and that was Spain. We had another empire on our northern border, that was Great Britain. And we had the French, very eager to reestablish a beachhead in North America, which they'd lost in the middle of the 18th century. All of those powers, if they had had greater proximity to the United States, could have very easily destabilized the United States in its early years. Instead, our geography is a big help for us. A second big help for us is our Constitution. The Constitution struck this remarkable balance between power and liberty. And it made liberty something that people prized, that people loved, that people enjoyed, and that they were willing to make tremendous sacrifices for. So when you put those two forces together, the fateful friendliness of geography, along with the principles captured by the Constitution, then you have something which weighs in a very formidable way for the protection, the defense, and the fostering of democracy in America. The great tragedy, of course, was that in 1861, we nearly threw all of that away.
There's a very interesting and important distinction between liberty, which we treasure, and the concept of democracy, which the Founding Fathers were very worried by. Can you describe their sense of why pure democracy was a dangerous concept?
Well, the one major example that they had in front of them of a pure democracy was Athens. And they didn't really think that Athens was going to give the United States very much in the way of direction, and for two reasons. One is the Athenian democracy really amounted to nothing more than the citizenry of Athens. We might say, 3,000 to 6,000 people in the Athenian assembly. And yes, it was a direct democracy, but it was also very small scale. In fact, it was deliberately small scale, because one of the problems of the Athenian democracy was that it resisted expansion of its citizen base. For the United States, just at the very beginning, we were already too big in 1787 to think about some kind of direct style Athenian democracy. So the first objection that the founders raised was simply one of scale. We just can't do it the way a city-state like Athens did. The second objection that they would raise was that the Athenian democracy didn't always do things right. James Madison made the point in the Federalist Papers that if every Athenian had been a Socrates, the assembly would still have been a mob. Because remember, Socrates, of course, was put to death by action of the Athenian assembly. So when they looked at the major example of a democracy, strictly speaking, they were very dicey about it. What they preferred, and Madison in particular preferred, was to talk about a republic. A republic and a democracy share one basic thing in common, and that is they believe that sovereignty belongs to the people, not to kings, not to the nobility, to the people. The way, however, the people manifest that sovereignty is different. In a democracy, you do it directly. In a republic, you do it indirectly through representatives. And Madison presumed that the representatives who would make these kinds of decisions would be the wiser, the more balanced, the more property, the people who are willing to take responsibility. So the founders start out with the assumption that the United States is a republic rather than a democracy, and that's what's captured in the Constitution. But it didn't really stay that way. That line between democracy and republic was, as it turned out, surprisingly porous. And porous because, for one thing, there never really developed in America that class of elites that Madison thought should have the ruling authority. Instead, what you get is something of the reverse. Instead of the representatives limiting the follies of the people in general, you get a situation, and this is what Tocqueville describes in Democracy in America, you get a situation where it is the people who limit what the representatives can do. So very early on, you get a situation where people are starting to use the terms democracy and republic interchangeably, as though they were synonyms. And that, as I say, that happens very early. So that by the time we get to Lincoln, Lincoln himself is using the term democracy and republic as though it really meant the same thing.
The Founding Fathers literally identified the Senate with Rome and the Roman Republic, and had the judges approved by the Senate. In that sense, even today, the very act of having a Senate is a step back towards the Roman Republic rather than the Athenian democracy. And I think that's something people tend to forget.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Even the very name, Senate, this is what is drawn from the example of the Roman Republic, where the Senate was, in fact, the most important deliberative body for the Republic.
So, given that background, and I gather the enormous sense of pride in the American system that existed as Lincoln was growing up, How did Lincoln approach the preservation of liberty and the preservation of the American Republic as we began to drift into a crisis between North and South?
He started from a baseline that understood that there were really two really important things that you needed to understand in order to have liberty. One was going to be consent, the consent of the governed. He says this very early in the run towards presidential office. This is in 1854, in October, in a great speech he gives in Peoria, Illinois. And he talks about consent. He says that's the sheet anchor of American republicanism. He actually uses the word republicanism there. It's also the speech where he uses that phrase, our ancient faith, because there he talks about the Declaration of Independence, and he insists the Declaration of Independence is our ancient faith. It articulates in its basis exactly what it is America is, and he would later say that he'd never had a thought politically that was not contained in the Declaration of Independence. So for him, you start out with these two baselines. You start out with the Declaration of Independence, and especially you start out with the idea of consent. For him, that is the basic definition of what a democracy is. And in fact, that's actually how he captures it at one point in 1858, because he makes this statement, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy. So for him, consent, the Declaration, that's where we start when we're talking about a democracy.
When you think about that, I've used constantly Lincoln's line that with popular sentiment, anything is possible. Without popular sentiment, nothing is possible. And trying to get across it, that effective legislation and effective policies have to grow from the people, not be imposed on them.
This is very much the case, because for Lincoln, sovereignty, the idea that sovereignty belongs to the people, is absolutely key. The country, he once said, belongs to the people who inhabit it. So when you are talking about what a democracy is, you have to start by understanding that sovereignty, there's no hierarchy, there's no pyramid, there's no nobles, there's no king. It is the people themselves who are the sovereigns. And curiously, I think that the one provision in the Constitution which underscores that so dramatically, and it's a provision that we often miss, it's at the end of Article 1, Section 9, where it says there will be no titles of nobility in America. Well, as soon as you've said that, you've wiped out centuries of aristocratic, monarchic, dictatorial rule. So you start with sovereignty. All right, how is sovereignty manifested? It's manifested with three things. One is elections. Free and fair and frequent elections are the key to the people's exercise of sovereignty and consent. Because otherwise, he said, you can't have free government without elections. Because elections are about accountability. Elections say to office holders, 2 years from now, 4 years from now, you're going to have to give an account to the people of what you've done. So every elected official knows they're not permanently installed. Majorities are another part of this. Sovereignty in the people is manifested by majority rule. Majorities rule. Now, here's the key thing. Majorities rule, but they don't suppress minorities. Minorities dissent, but they don't subvert the majorities. And the thing which keeps all of these functioning together, sovereignty, elections, majorities, is law. Because law is what keeps reason central to a democratic system. Otherwise, if you don't have reason, then the people wind up being governed by what he called passion. And for him, passion is a bad word. Passion is what happens when mobs take over. Mobs lead to anarchy, anarchy leads to despotism, and that's the end of democracy. So those for Lincoln really become the key features of what he's talking about when he speaks about democracy.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, if, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It seems to me that Lincoln is the person who resurrects the Declaration of Independence and makes it central. The Constitution had been more focused on in the previous 60 or 70 years, but Lincoln literally weaves the Declaration of Independence into his entire political philosophy and dates the whole process at Gettysburg from this magnificent document. Is it accurate to think that Lincoln is the one who reasserts the Declaration as the heart of the American system?
Well, he doesn't do it single-handedly. There are many people who will rise up along with him and who will say, we cannot abandon the Declaration. He's articulating the point of view that many people held in 1861. The difficulty is that there were also many people who had taken a different road. The most obvious of the people who had taken that different road was John Calhoun of South Carolina. And John Calhoun is taking a road which says the Declaration of Independence was wrong. All men are not created equal. And since all men are not created equal, therefore it's legitimate for some of us to enslave some of them. We can reduce them to slavery. Well, they're not really equal to us. The Declaration is wrong. To us, that sounds simply astonishing. Coming from a man, as John Calhoun had been, who had been Vice President of the United States, under two different presidents, by the way, and a Secretary of War, a United States Senator. But he's very frank about saying it. We got it all wrong in 1776. And the people who rally around him to say that the Declaration of Independence is wrong are in large measure going to be the slaveholders of the South. Because that is what helps them to justify the very human slavery that Lincoln condemns as a contradiction of democracy.
Because he so clearly condemned it and did so much earlier than people normally think, was he really surprised that the South wouldn't tolerate his victory?
I think he was to a larger degree than we imagine, because remember, Lincoln was born in Kentucky, and then he's raised in southern Indiana, which is still part of that great border section of the country, which owes a great deal to the South. And Lincoln really believed that he understood how Southerners thought. And that led him to conclude that all of this talk about secession, about rebellion, all of this was really the activity of a very tiny cadre of revolutionary figures in the South. And he'll persist in thinking that even into the war years, he will insist that what makes the Confederacy work, so to speak, is that it's a military coup d'etat. The Confederacy is really just its army. Its officials are just the military. And by and large, the generality of the people of the South retain their loyalty and commitment to the principles of the Declaration. I think he might have been more than a little optimistic in that judgment, because in weighing, as I do, the way the Confederacy resisted and the number of lives lost in the process of that resistance, my fear is that there were more people willing to embrace the song of John C. Calhoun in the South than Lincoln wanted to believe. And that is what makes the Civil War as protracted and as bloody as it turns out to be.
Ultimately, Southern nationalism, if you will, guaranteed that it would be a people's war and that you would have to literally destroy their capacity to fight.
And that eventually is what he begins to see as a necessity, so that he will turn to someone like Ulysses Grant, who understands that the real kind of war you need to make is on the Southern capacity to resist. You're not going to put an end to the war simply by marching onto a battlefield and having a tete-a-tete with a Confederate army. I mean, for one thing, by the 19th century, armies are so big, you just don't win catastrophic victories like Napoleon might have won at Austerlitz. The technology of weapons, the technology of war has changed so much in the 50 years since Napoleon Bonaparte. So you're just not going to win a battle like you'd win a football game or a football title. You're going to have to destroy the very power to resist. Grant sees that, Sherman sees that, and in the long run, that is what brings victory to the nation in 1865.
I'm impressed with the fact that confronted with that, Lincoln had the sheer moral courage to accept that if that was the price of preserving the Union, it was a price that had to be paid, no matter how distasteful.
Yes, but he never wants to pay that in any kind of vengeful spirit. He wants the war to end so badly that he's willing to meet with Confederate emissaries. And he's willing to do this either directly or indirectly as early as the summer of 1864. But he actually goes and meets with three Confederate emissaries at Hampton Roads in February of 1865. And he makes it very clear to them that there's a non-negotiable. The non-negotiable is they lay down their weapons and slavery is done. But then he says, the way that we end slavery, I'm still willing to talk about that as a process. We want to get the war over. We want the killing to stop. He comes back to his cabinet and tries to explain this to them. The cabinet tells him, no, you can't do that. That's not going to work. But what it says is that Lincoln felt so very keenly what the war was costing, that he would entertain, however fleetingly, he would entertain whatever might bring peace to the country. My old colleague, Gabor Borat, whom you have known, Newt, once wrote an essay, and in that essay he said something that really struck me, that stayed with me all the many years since. And that is, in July of 1864, a Confederate division is threatening Washington, the northern defenses of Washington. Lincoln goes out to Fort Stevens to see this. Lincoln stands up on the parapet of Fort Stevens, where every Confederate skirmisher could take a shot at him. And Gabor wondered, was Lincoln thinking, God, if I am wrong, let it end here? And then in the most eloquent way, he comes to the second inaugural. And Newt, he could very easily, in that second inaugural address, because the war is obviously coming to an end on March 4th, 1865. Everybody can see that. He could have done a victory lap. He could have said, see, we were right, they were wrong. Time for us to have a big party. And he doesn't. He doesn't. Instead, he says, look, this horrible war that we have endured for 4 years is a visitation of God's judgment on all of us, North and South. We have all had our hands imbrued in slavery. None of us is innocent. And the judgment of God on all of us is manifest in this war. And anyone who wants to dispute that and protest their own righteousness and their own clean hands just doesn't know how God functions. And it's because of that, he says, we have to proceed with malice toward none and with charity for all. Lincoln understands that vengeance is as toxic to the life of a democracy as any external threat. And that is what he is pleading for, even there at the end of the war.
I've gone, as I know you have, to the Lincoln Memorial, and it's so stirring and so moving to first read aloud the Gettysburg Address and then to turn and read the second inaugural, which has multiple references to God, and which really is a sermon. It's probably the most amazing of all American inaugural addresses. And you think about what's going on in this guy's mind, having presided over and in a sense insisted on a nationwide bloodbath for 4 long years, which could have ended any time he was willing to quit. But because he believed in the Union and that the very cause of freedom was at stake, he wouldn't quit no matter the cost. And it must have been literally a constant agony for him and totally different from what he expected when he ran initially.
Oh, I know. He understood that what was going on in the war was the biggest question that democracy could be asked. And that is, are democracies really stable? Are they really permanent? Are they for real? I mean, there's so many other issues that are bound up with the war. There's the issue of, you know, are we a nation or are we just a league of independent states like the old Holy Roman Empire? All right, that's one question that has to get settled in the war. And the other question, big question, is slavery. I get email all the time from people who want to say, well, you know, it was really about states' rights. It was not about slavery. That's balderdash. Everybody knew in 1861 that slavery was big ticket issue. The seceding states say this over and over again in their secession documents. But even bigger than slavery, is an issue we don't often reflect upon because we don't need to. And that is the survival of the American democracy. Newt, think about it this way. In 1776, we declare our independence. We create this democratic republic. And it looks like we are the coming thing because 1789, the French overthrow monarchical rule. And it looks like this is going to be the wave of the future. But then you know what happens. The French Revolution descends into the Reign of Terror. The Reign of Terror descends into the dictatorship of Bonaparte. You get the Napoleonic Wars. You get the Congress of Vienna and the restoration of monarchy. In 1861, the United States is the last large-scale democratic experiment still functioning in the world. If the United States blows it, if we can't hold together, then that just simply shows to every monarch around the world that democracy is a joke, that people cannot govern themselves. And Lincoln says this to his secretary, John Hay, in May of 1861. He says, the fundamental issue that we are facing in this war is whether self-government is possible or whether every time you hit a big problem, a democracy is simply going to blow up. So he understood the enormous significance of what was happening in the United States. And as a matter of fact, you know, so did people in other places. All the monarchs were cheering on the Confederacy. Like the King of Belgium said that the Confederacy is the sign of the return of what he called the aristocratic monarchical principle in the New World. On the other hand, the Friends of Liberty in Europe were cheering for the Union. because they saw in it the future of liberty being put to a test. Even slaves working in the sugar fields of Cuba were singing along with whatever songs they sang. They were interpolating these words, "Avanza, Lincoln, avanza, tu eres esperanza, you are our hope." People understood the biggest issue of all was this issue of democracy. And we enjoy today the fruit of that, sometimes without realizing just how much in danger it was in the American Civil War years.
Your point, I mean, Lincoln captures it himself in the Gettysburg Address when he says, "Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure." I mean, I think he just sort of captured right there that this was the ultimate test to whether humans could govern themselves.
You might say that the Civil War was looked upon by Lincoln as the final exam for American democracy. He said there were three things a democracy had to do. First of all, it had to set itself up. Second of all, it had to find a way of establishing its own governing rules. We do that in the Constitution. And then it has to show that it's not going to fly to pieces from within. And he said, that is the question that is now before us in this Civil War. And in a lot of ways, Newt, I wrote this book because I think that question is before us in every American generation. I mean, Lincoln settles it in his day, but it gets unsettled from time to time. I think we're living in an era of unsettlement. And one of the reasons, if not the prime reason, that I wrote the book was to say, can we look back to Lincoln and see what Lincoln had to say about democracy? To say what he had to say in praise of it, but also the moments when he points out its weak links, and it does have them. And can we learn for today some of the lessons that Lincoln wanted to teach for people in his day? That, to me, was the most important thing I could say in this book, because you notice, Newt, I'm a history person. This is not a narrative history, all right? This is not a biography of Lincoln. This is really a series of meditations on these themes of democracy that Lincoln himself was concerned about. And I write this in a way to speak to our anxieties today.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Scott Rasmussen has been doing polling for 35 years. And he recently developed what he calls the elite 1%. And these are basically people who went to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, etc., got a graduate degree. Didn't just go to grad school, but got a degree, earn at least $150,000 a year, and live in a large city. This 1%, he said the most frightening single number in 35 years of polling. He asked the question, would you cheat if you were in danger of losing an election? 7% of the country says yes. 65% of these people said yes. So you have an elite which is basically valuing the imposition of its values over the preservation of a system of all of us mutually choosing who leads us. I think it fits what Lincoln was worried about. Every generation has to come back and renew its dedication to this extraordinarily complex system that the founding fathers gave us, which happens to work.
This is why he's at Gettysburg. I mean, Lincoln didn't leave Washington very often during the Civil War. I mean, understand the sense in which I mean this. It's a compliment. The man was a workaholic. He was at his desk. He was at work all the time. He did not stray very much out of Washington to go on, you know, fundraising tours or things like that. But he does make an exception to come to Gettysburg in November of 1863 for the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery there. Why does he do that? Because he has seen something in that battle. He has seen something in the 3,500 Union dead who are buried in that cemetery. These are ordinary folks, Newt. I mean, you've walked around that cemetery, as I have many times, and you see the names there. They're not the names of the rich and famous. They're the names of people who a couple of months before had gotten off the boat from Europe. They're the names of clerks and farmers. And yet those ordinary people saw something in democracy that they were willing to surrender their lives for. And that pushes him to say in the Gettysburg Address, it's not us who are going to dedicate a cemetery here. They've already done that. Rather, it's for us to dedicate ourselves to that great task for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. And that is a dedication that has to be renewed over and over again. And he is confident that it can be renewed. The statistic you were quoting from Rasmussen is a really disheartening one. But I don't think that Lincoln would have been disheartened, because he understood that democracies have these great capacities. Democracies have this tremendous resilience. Democracies have humor. They can laugh at themselves, like Lincoln did. Democracies have humility. Elites and elite governments and aristocracies and 1% are all built on honor and self-righteousness, but not a democracy. A democracy is built on so many other things that it thrives on. And if the people of that democracy will see in it the rainbow of promise, then that democracy will survive. It will prosper. It will have a new birth of freedom. not, as my friend Rick Kaiser says, and rightly, not a birth of new freedom. We're not going to rewrite all the rules all over again and have something entirely different as a governing way of doing things. No, we are going to have a renewal, a rebirth of the original purpose of this democracy. That dedication, I believe, springs from the people themselves. We've had faithless elites before. We have the Tories of the Revolution. Even the slave-owning oligarchs of the Confederacy. Talk about an elite. Newt, do you realize that in the 1860 census, the richest county in America was Adams County, Mississippi, highest in terms of net worth? Why? Slavery, plantations. That's where the elite were. And they were wrong. And they gambled wrong on rebellion. And they lost. And frankly, I'll say for myself, and probably get some hate mail for it, I'm glad they lost. I'm glad that Lincoln was right. I'm glad that we triumphed as a nation without slavery. And I want us to continue that way.
But to balance it a little bit, because it gets complex, Lincoln, if necessary, was willing to bend the rules to suppress dissent, which he thought could cost us the nation. And while he was himself a great lawyer, he was prepared to say, you can't use the rules to justify suicide. And therefore, they did a number of things, from locking up half the Maryland legislature to closing down some newspapers, etc. How do you balance the necessity of survival against the very system that you're trying to have survive?
I don't know that there is a balance you can prescribe. I don't know if there's an algorithm for it. I can explain what Lincoln did. I mean, for one thing, Lincoln is working without a template. We've never had a civil war before, so he couldn't look up what the precedents were. There was no bookstore he could go to and buy a copy of Civil War for Dummies. That just wasn't anything. He's having to improvise, and improvise in a volatile situation whose result he can't really easily predict. And Newt, I'll say this, just in case anyone thinks that I'm a Lincoln worshiper. He makes mistakes. And I think he made mistakes in some points, in other points. I think he makes mistakes on some of the civil liberties issues as well. When he arrests, for instance, the prominent draft dissenter, Clement Vallandigham, in 1863, a former representative, because they gerrymandered his district out from under him. I mean, Vallandigham gives a speech in Mount Vernon, Ohio, and it's a pretty incendiary piece of work. And he's arrested by military authorities, tried by a military tribunal. They're going to send him to Fort Warren in Boston Harbor to spend the rest of the war behind bars. No writ of habeas corpus. And Lincoln has to justify what happens to Vallandigham. And he does it, I'm sorry to say, on the basis of what he calls necessity. He says the Constitution is different in a time of stress, in a time of necessity, a time of civil war, than it is in times of peace. Note, he was wrong. He was wrong. And the wrongness of it becomes apparent a year after the war in Ex parte Milligan, where the Supreme Court, in a decision written by a man appointed by Lincoln to the Supreme Court, it says, no, 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 the Constitution is the same document in peace as it is in war. And it's still the law of the land under any of those circumstances. So he makes mistakes. The curious thing is, and this is also part of the explanation, this is what I think sometimes people miss when they rush to say, oh, Lincoln tried to be a dictator. No, no. If you look at the number of these kinds of arrests that happen, military tribunal trials and so on like that, the actual number of them is vanishingly small. Out of a northern population of 22 million, maybe there were 300 arrests you could point to as political. And in many cases, they're not even undertaken at Lincoln's behest. They're undertaken by military department commanders. And in almost every case that I'm aware of, people, in order to be released, all they had to do was to take an oath of allegiance to the United States. So even when you examine these cases carefully, even then, even when Lincoln is making a mistake, it's not a fatal mistake. Of course it's not a fatal mistake, because if it had been a fatal mistake, why are we not living in a dictatorship today? No, the war is over. We go right back to being what we were. Lincoln hadn't revolutionized anything that way. So, yes, I'm going to tell you, I hope it doesn't come as a surprise, Lincoln did not walk on the Potomac. All right, we've got him in the Lincoln Memorial there, but he did not walk on the Potomac. He made mistakes. And I think he would have said the same thing.
I've always thought the Gettysburg Address, in addition to being poetry and remarkably spiritual, in some ways was the kickoff speech of his reelection campaign and sort of created an amazing moral dilemma that in the end to vote against Lincoln was to vote that these young men should have died in vain. Do you think he had any sense of framing 64 when he gave the speech in November of 63?
People had suggested that one of the reasons he does come to Gettysburg is because there's a certain concern that the governor of Pennsylvania, Republican Governor Andrew Curtin, might have been a possible rival for the Republican nomination. I think that's pushing things to extremes. Lincoln doesn't betray any sign while he's at Gettysburg, while he's going to Gettysburg, while he's coming back from Gettysburg, that he felt that he needed to start taking out an insurance policy for his reelection or his renomination. Actually, at that point in the fall of 1863, things were really looking very good for him. He had written a public letter in September of 1863 in which he talked about how the Mississippi River, the father of waters, now flows unvexed to the sea, how the prospects for peace do not look so far off as they seemed. So I don't think he's coming to Gettysburg because he's got reelection anxieties at that point. He will have reelection anxieties months later when it appears that the war has stalemated, and that's what will lead him in August of 1864 to write a document that he has his cabinet endorse, saying it does not look like this administration is going to be reelected. But I think in the fall of 1863, he's got other things on his mind. He really wants to point us in the direction of where he thinks peace lies. And the path to peace is really going to have to lie through that action of dedication that he describes in the address.
Do you think, if Lincoln had survived, that Reconstruction would have been dramatically different?
Well, it wouldn't have been worse, that's for sure. It's hard to imagine how we could have botched Reconstruction more. And a large measure of that is due to Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson. There are dangers in posing what-if questions, you know, as a history person. And wherever I go, people ask me exactly this question. What do you think would have happened if Lincoln had served out that second term to which he was elected in November of 64? Well, part of me wants to say, who can answer that question? You just can't know. But I get asked it so many times that I'll yield the point. In fact, I yield that point in the epilogue of the book, and I say, all right, I'll break my own rule and I'll speculate. I think certainly he would have put his shoulder to the wheel for black voting. He's already giving the signs of that in the year before his death. I think he probably would have looked for a longer Reconstruction period, probably with more involvement of the military. Not so much because he wanted to suppress the South, as because he wanted to give a chance for an entirely new political generation to grow up in the South. And as it is, Reconstruction, strictly defined, really only lasts 12 years. That's not a whole lot of time to do things. And I think there's probably some value to wondering if Lincoln would have paid attention to the economic future of the freed slaves. Here are people who have worked this land, and it was a tenet of liberal democracy all the way back to John Locke, that you establish ownership of property by mixing your labor with the land. And I think he would have looked at lands that are abandoned by Confederate officials who flee into exile as fair game for assigning to the slaves. He starts to do that on the Sea Islands, on the coastal strip of Georgia and South Carolina before the end of the war. And I think he probably would have looked to that as giving the freed slaves not just the vote, but the economic heft to go along with it to support this advance into full and equal citizenship. But, so I'm going to put a but in here. He would only have been president for 3 more years if he observes the usual two-term rule, which at that point was not specified yet in the Constitution. That's not going to be a whole lot of time to supervise it. So even if he had had all these intentions that I'm talking about, he might not have had the time. And even then, the challenge of Reconstruction was so enormous. It's entirely possible it might have been beyond the grasp even of Abraham Lincoln to pull off with success. We just don't know. All that we can say is we probably could not have done worse than we did.
You've always been remarkably insightful. Every time I turn to you for advice, you bring a perspective that's extraordinarily educated and at the same time has an amazing amount of wisdom. So I really want to thank you for joining me. Your new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment, it's so helpful in replacing our understanding of how a divided nation can in fact find a way forward. And it's very relevant today in terms of the principles we should apply. And Our Ancient Faith is available on Amazon and the bookstores everywhere, and it will be on our show page. So I just want to thank you personally for taking this kind of time to help educate the rest of us.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Always a pleasure.
Thank you to my guest, Alan C. Gelzo. You can get a link to buy his new book, Our Ancient Faith, Lincoln, Democracy, and the American Experiment, on our show page at NewsWorld.com. NewsWorld is produced by Gingrich 360 and iHeartMedia. Our executive producer is Garnsey Sloan, and our researcher is Rachel Peterson. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360. If you've been enjoying News World, I hope you'll go to Apple Podcasts and both rate us with 5 stars and give us a review so others can learn what it's all about. Right now, listeners of News World can sign up for my 3 free weekly columns at gingrich360.com/newsletter. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.